Haven't heard much from North Korea in a while, which I guess is why they fired off a pretty aggressive missile. Let's go to CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. So tell us about this missile they fired, Jeff.
Well, Dave, this is the first time in about 5 years that they have fired a missile over Japan. This was an intermediate range ballistic missile, is what they call a Wamsung 12, and it resulted in the Japanese declaring a national alert as they told people to take cover as this missile passed over Japanese territory, then splashing into the Pacific Ocean. This is the 23rd missile test that the North Koreans have conducted this year and five in the last 10 days. So clearly Kim Jong-un is demonstrating that he has that particular missile capability. And now close attention is being taken to some of the areas where we know they do nuclear research, as there's a widespread belief in the next few weeks we may see a nuclear test by the North Koreans.
Can I ask why now? Does it have anything to do with what's happening with Russia and China's involvement as well?
I don't think it's so much with Russia and their involvement with the Chinese. I think it has more to do with what's happening in Northeast Asia. The United States is conducting a series of military exercises with the South Koreans. They were doing some practice bombing and missile deliveries over the last couple of days. You had the vice president, of course, visit South Korea, and she went up to the militarized zone. You've had the election in the last few months of a new, very conservative government in Korea that's talking more about a hard line towards North Korea, closer ties with the United States, and also trying to improve relations between Japan and South Korea. Obviously, the North Koreans take that as a matter of concern and as a matter of threat.
So I noticed that this missile was considered to be nuclear capable, but they did not attempt to load a warhead into it. Or did they load a dummy warhead to mimic the weight of a nuclear warhead? Do you know?
Yeah, I'm not know for sure, Dave, but my guess is we would have had a dummy warhead on board. And that's one thing as we worry about, could North Korea in fact threaten the United States or even some other countries in the region with a nuclear weapon? We know they have nuclear weapons. We know they've tested weapons. The real question is, have they been able to miniaturize a nuclear weapon to the size that would fit into a nose cone of a missile? And then second of all, have they gotten the engineering down whereby for an intercontinental system that it could survive reentry and bring the warhead down on target? Those are unknowns, and we haven't seen them test that type of what's called a bus in terms of reentry through the atmosphere for an international system that might threaten the United States.
So we would know if they actually put in a live nuclear warhead and had something like that ready to launch. Is that correct?
So we would not know, I think, for absolute certain, except perhaps at the highest level of intelligence, because, again, it comes down to miniaturization. We know they have the weapon. Do they have the miniaturized? And if we see that they've tested a bus that can survive reentry, then we would know they have the capability of putting a nuclear weapon, you know, on that particular. But that's still, you know, it's still unknown. You can't necessarily tell from afar if a particular weapon has a nuclear weapon on board. And don't forget, Dave, you know, as an old friend of mine who was a Korean expert once said to me, we know more about black holes in the galaxy at times than we know about what goes on in North Korea.
Okay, but what I'm getting at is, what's the line? At what point do we say, okay, this is bad enough that we have to blow it up before they launch it?
I think if we saw them preparing to do a launch, which clearly in a period of heightened tensions where there are other things that occurred which suggested a movement of military forces towards the DMZ, a movement of, you know, material that looked like it was clearly nuclear that might be moving towards where launch pads were created, then that might be the reason to go ahead and try to preempt. Problem is, of course, now we believe they have 30 to 40 weapons. And if you think that you can take them all out, that's fine. But trying to take out one or a few or even allowing them to survive a couple means they could still have the capability to launch a weapon that might hit Seoul, that might hit Tokyo or other areas in the region with devastating effect.
Let's talk about the other nuclear equation. Russia, Vladimir Putin, has increased his rhetoric about the fact that the U.S. has launched nuclear weapons, saying it's we set the precedent. Is this him desperate to ratchet up attention and power?
I think to a certain degree that's exactly true, Colleen. Some of this is for domestic consumption. That speech you cited there he spent a lot of time talking about the war in Ukraine being between the West and Russia, and that this should rally the Russian people. We have to defend the motherland. This is an existential threat to us. Don't forget that in that same period of time, he called for 300,000 reservists to be called up. And we've seen more young Russians, I think, flee the country in the last week than have actually fought in Ukraine. So part of it is for domestic consumption. Part of it is to try to intimidate the West, most certainly not only the United States, but the Ukrainians and the Western Europeans as he kind of rattles that nuclear saber.
Does anybody buy that in Russia, that Ukraine is a threat to the motherland, implying, or is he now counting as the motherland those areas of Ukraine that he formerly incorporated?
Yeah, that's a great, great question, Dave. But I'll tell you what, occasionally I will watch clips from Russian television, and there are some very extreme right-wing, xenophobic, nationalistic TV and radio broadcasts. Because don't forget, all the ones that opposed the war were closed.
Right.
That have all the time described Ukraine as a threat, that NATO is going to put missiles there to threaten Russia, that there are biological and chemical weapons factories created by the United States and Ukraine. Those kind of claims and disinformation are a steady spew out of those particular facilities to the Russian population.
Now,
in general, prior to this, we suggest that most Russians, I think, were pretty apathetic or sort of nonchalantly supported the war. We've seen that dropping in the last week, as best you can trust polls, as a coast now it's reaching into their homes as 300,000 young Russians are being called to service.
Yeah. Now, how real is the Ukrainian response to Russia's phony referendum? I mean, have they securely recaptured some of those areas, or is that just temporary?
Well, the whole thing is pretty absurd. It was a sham election to begin with. I mean, somebody shows up at your door with two guys with guns and hands you a ballot and watches you fill it out. You kind of get an idea what they want you to do. You know, so it was a sham to begin with. Of course, he claims four provinces. Oh, by the way, his troops didn't even control all four of those provinces the day he announced that annexation. And now in the last couple of days, what have we seen? Ukrainians continue to advance. They recaptured the city of Lyman, a very strategic rail center in the Donbass region. People of Lyman were Russian citizens for one day based on that annexation. And then also down the south, it appears now large reports that Ukrainians have broken through on the northwestern side of the pocket of Kherson, and there may be a possibility in the coming days of them encircling literally thousands of Russian troops in Kherson. The fall of that would be an enormous, enormous psychological and diplomatic disaster for the Russians and Putin.
So it sounds real. CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Dave.
Chug Points, brought to you by Acton's Quality Roofing. That fire under the Ship Canal Bridge last week just demonstrates how dangerous it is to use freeways as your roof if you're homeless. And it also, of course, puts drivers in danger. The camp is now being targeted by the state under a new program that's already showing some positive results. Let's go to Chris for some of the details on this.
And it's called the Right-Away Safety Initiative. The legislature and the governor got it launched it earlier this year to great fanfare. It's a program that finally throws all of the players together to remove these camps and get the residents into housing. The new funding, $143 million in total so far, has targeted homeless camps in King, Pierce, Thurston, Snohomish, and Spokane counties. The Washington Department of Transportation's Barbara LeBeau says the money helps the local agencies on the ground go into these camps, assess what the people need, and find them places to stay before they go in and clear the areas, which are on state land.
The focus on this is not just to merely move someone from the encampment, although those areas are not safe, but to find them a better living situation, be that shelter or on the pathway to permanent housing.
LeBeau says they focused on some of the biggest camps along I-5 and I-90 so far, clearing five of them already, three in Thurston County and two in King County, largest being that one at Dearborn and I-5 in Seattle that I know a lot of us are familiar with. One of the challenges with clearing homeless camps is that the people generally never have a place to go when that camp is swept. They just move on down the road. With this program, the housing is set up before those camps are cleared. And so far, LeBeau says the program has shown some success.
98 people were offered housing. You know, sometimes that's shelter, sometimes that's permanent housing. And of that 98, 77 accepted.
That's a really big number. Usually in a lot of these cases, there you go in and the people refuse the help for a variety of reasons. And we've seen that historically. But that's a really good number. And what's also positive about this is that they're remaining in housing. A recent check back on that of the people that have been removed from those camps, of the 77 who accepted help, 73 of them are still in some form of housing. And that's great news.
If you go in and just try to move people, they likely will just find another place to live outside. And that's not the end goal that we want. That's not good for them. It's not good for the overall community. So this one takes a little longer, but it's seeming to have better outcomes on the end.
And unlike the sweeps, this program spends a lot of time in the camp before ever giving notice of removal, so workers can build up some trust with those camps and find them places to go.
We don't announce ahead of time that we're going to go to X site, because that's not how we want someone living there to find out about that. So we begin the outreach and let them understand what the process is. And then when it gets close to when we're actually going to clear the site and they'll be transitioned off, we will then post a 72-hour notice.
Now, that said, LeBeau says the Ship Canal Bridge encampments on either side of the I-5 express lanes are now on the radar.
That Ship Canal site is one of the ones we're aware of, and we do have outreach groups already making some contacts there.
The goal is to take this model statewide to all state rights of way, but that will require a lot more money going forward.
So once these places are cleared, they then become a temptation for other people to move in, right? Maybe not the same people, but other people. So are there patrols that nip that in the bud?
Well, they fence up a lot of these places and try to prevent it from happening again. But it's one of those things where you're right. As soon as one goes away, or people maybe come and start moving back, but they continue to work on that process to keep that from happening going forward. But what I like out of this so far, and from what we've seen historically, is that more people, it seemed like, at least through this program, are accepting the help, which is great. And they're still in housing, you know, a month and a half later as they check through the process, which is obviously the goal. I mean, we want the people to have a place, safe place to live, but along the freeway isn't it. And they've got to do something. And it seems like this program is having minimal success at the beginning. We'll see how it goes.
Not to change the subject, but they mentioned the graffiti at all?
No, not at all. That's a different issue. Those people are generally not homeless. Those are people that come in. And what happens in Seattle, and this is going to continue until we keep the express lanes open at night, because basically they close the express lanes when they're done going northbound in the evening, and they're off until 5 a.m. the next morning. You can just walk along the freeway with unfettered access along I-5. You can just walk on at any on-ramp, get into the express lanes, and then from there you have access to the main freeway. You can climb up the the posts and things, and so they've kind of ceded that property because
they're doing... Wouldn't that be easy pickings for a police car just rolling down the vacant express lanes? That's automatically trespassing, and you can round people up.
You would think so, but the problem with that is that there's so many easy ways to get off the road there, because they're on and off, or you can just jump and parts of the express lanes right as you go down here just north of us in Eastlake. You can run down the side, next thing you know you're on Eastlake, or you're working your way towards Montlake, and so they're very mobile, and it can be very different. And again, you're going to spend the whole night chasing one or two people tagging, but yeah, it's the fact that we've seeded that area in the middle of the freeway overnight, I think you've got unfettered access.
And the money is on the way. Every county in the state is going to get a portion of that $500 million-plus settlement in Washington's lawsuit against the three largest opioid distributors. Let's go live now to Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, our state attorney general, Bob Ferguson, says no amount of money will bring back the lives lost to the opioid epidemic.
All of us have spoken to and met with folks who lost loved ones and colleagues to the crisis. So while this money cannot do that, and no amount of money could do that, these funds will help prevent the next victim of the opioid epidemic, because we know that there are not enough resources for the work we need on prevention and treatment and so many other issues.
Ferguson talking about the massive settlement Washington is getting from his lawsuit in 2019 against McKesson, Cardinal Health, and AmerisourceBergen.
The case was a failure, was about the failure of these three corporations to stop suspicious opioid shipments coming into Washington State and their failure to report those suspicious orders to the Drug Enforcement Agency as they are required to under law.
As for the more than $500 million settlement,
$215 million of the recovery will go directly to cities and counties to be used to heal communities in crisis. Local governments in all 39 counties will receive a portion of the settlement. And Washington is giving one of the higher percentages of the funds directly to its cities and counties in the nation. The local governments, by the way, they negotiated for themselves how to divide the money. So that was their resolution amongst themselves for that $215 million, how to divide that up. They did agree on a formula based on how many opioids were shipped in their communities, how many people died as a result of opioids, and how many people are currently suffering from opioid use disorder.
Now, here's how some of that breaks down.
The top five counties, including their local governments, will receive the following. So King County, again, the county, local jurisdictions will receive $56 million. Pierce County, approximately $26 million. Snohomish County, a little over $25 million. Spokane County, a little over $19 million. Clark County, nearly $15 million. An equal amount, $215 million, will go to the state of Washington. And additionally, I'm directing the entire $46 million reimbursement of my office's costs related to bringing and litigating this case. All of that money will go to the state of Washington as well. So in total, $261 million goes to the state of Washington. The legislature, of course, will decide ultimately how those funds are spent, but lawmakers, under the terms of the agreement, must use the funds to address the opioid epidemic.
Now, and what that means is
the consent decree aligns with our state's opioid response plan, and spending decisions by state and local governments must be consistent with that plan. Local governments will need to report how they're spending the money. So we have transparency throughout this process so the public can see how's the money being spent. There's a reporting mechanism built into this. Just to give you an idea of how the funds can and must be used, the resources can be used to fund desperately needed prevention strategies, including improved and expanded treatment options, addressing the needs of pregnant women and their families, including those with babies with neonatal disorder, youth-focused outreach and prevention efforts, support for first responders, and other evidence-based programs and services that can save lives and preserve families.
And we heard from some of the leaders from local jurisdictions at this press conference yesterday, including King County Councilmember Gurmai Zalhalai, who said he was hoping that a good portion of this money could be used in King County for some crisis centers that he's hoping will be coming up in some legislation in the near future. I hope to learn more about that soon, as well as a state Democratic Representative Tara Simmons, who says some of this money will likely be used to address the Blake fix.
Right now we have, through the Blake fix, we did for 2 years set up a substance use disorder navigator system. It's just coming online, and it needs more. We need to have warm handoffs in the community so a police officer can connect an individual suffering with opioid use disorder immediately to somebody potentially with lived experience who can help walk them through the path to recovery and get them into services. So I think that is a really strategic place that some of this funding can go to.
So explain the Blake fix.
Right. I was just going to. So just to remind everybody, the Blake fix is, Blake refers to the case that the state Supreme Court was looking at when it decided to toss our felony drug possession law. And that left us with no law for anybody who was busted with a small amount of personal drugs for their own use. In the end, the legislature put in a temporary law for 2 years that lowered that to a misdemeanor and required, though, mandatory pre-arrest referral diversion. So basically, if a cop sees you smoking your blues on the side of the street, they can say, look, you can't do that here. Here's a card for a referral to treatment, and off you go. But there's no tracking or any kind of, not enough treatment for that, mm-hmm. even if the person did want it, and there's no tracking. There's a lot of issues with it. So that's what the Blake issue is.
So this money then goes to provide the treatment that will allow them to issue those misdemeanors and get people off the streets immediately?
It again, so a couple of things on Blake. First of all, that was a two-year law that is going to sunset next July, which means this upcoming session, I would expect one of the very top priorities to be a permanent fix to the Blake decision. And I told you, I think before, there's a couple of options on the table that I have heard, none of which are returning that to a felony when you're caught with drugs like that. So could stay as a misdemeanor, could be that they go a different way and lessen that.
What does it mean on the ground? I mean, does this mean that once the I can't imagine they're going to do anything that would put more druggies on the street. So don't you think they're more likely to do something that allows the police to take people off the street immediately and put them into the treatment centers that are now being paid for by this settlement?
Yes, but I want to make sure that so this was one facet. So part of this money is going to the state, $261 million. And part of that, Tara Simmons is saying, may well be used as they work on this Blake permanent fix. But a lot of this other money, local jurisdictions getting a big chunk of this money is huge because there is not enough treatment anywhere in the state, whether you're doing a county, city, whatever jurisdiction you're in. So there are all these types of programs that will this will likely be used for, as well as the implementation of the 988 system. Remember when I covered that, there's a big push to get these instant, right, basically care on demand, treatment on demand, right, where you can walk in like an urgent care 24/7 when you're ready to get that treatment for your addiction, and they can do it for you right there. Those are the types of models that they want to set up. So I think some of this would be used by local jurisdictions and the state, for that matter, to implement some of those things. The other thing that's interesting about this is you heard him mention supporting funding first responders. That means that this money can also be used by every jurisdiction that's getting it to pay for the hiring of more fire and police personnel.
Okay, that's good. But I heard you insert the phrase treatment, quote, when you're ready. I think what most taxpayers want at this point is treatment when we catch you. So is that possible or is that still illegal?
There is a piece of legislation that passed last session that should be coming online soon that does, it has to do with the Involuntary Treatment Act and expanding that to include those who are dealing with substance use disorder, which would allow to some degree forced treatment in the name of involuntary treatment. Again, the problem is that there's not the treatment centers to back that up yet. So this money
could go for that. But we have the money for that now.
We do. So, okay. Oh, and I need to say, this is a multi-year settlement. The first chunk of the payment is going to come starting this December, so December 1st, and that is going to be the bulk of the payment. I think $55 million is the first part of the payment is what King County will get. It's a good chunk of change, so we'll see how they use that right away.
All right. Car News Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness, brought to you by Baird. Teenagers are getting help overcoming some of life's difficult challenges in order to write their own futures with a college education. CBS's Meg Oliver has the story.
Nancy Rico Mineras is a first-generation college student in her junior year at NYU.
I was below the poverty line, and I never saw myself going to college. I never thought that was an option for me.
Growing up in Camden, New Jersey, at times her parents had to choose between paying the electric bill or buying food.
It was very difficult.
Despite the financial hardship, her late mother, who died from COVID her freshman year, encouraged her to apply for college and scholarships. That's when she found the Horatio Alger Association. Since 1984, it's given out $235 million in scholarships to students in need. Students like Angel Vigil, who spent years bouncing between family and foster homes.
If it wasn't because of the scholarships, I would not be able to attend university.
He's now a sophomore at Arizona State University.
Now I see myself being able to complete college and eventually become a surgeon.
If somebody would have told me that I would come to NYU, I would not be able to believe them or like yet to afford to come here.
Here, where her life has changed forever. Meg Oliver, CBS News, New York.
7:48 and now from the G and Ursula Show, here's G. Scott. I missed Monday Night Football, so I'm going to play the clip of what happened. Here's how Eli and Peyton Manning called the play involving former Seahawk Bobby Wagner.
Here you go. Oh, yeah.
There he is. Yes. There he is. Not, yes.
Oh, yes.
That's what we're talking
Wagner.
About. Wagner.
Bobby.
A veteran, right? Get him down. Now get out and tackle. Let these guys take over.
It was a naked guy
No.
No, he wasn't naked. He wasn't naked. He had clothes on.
He had clothes on. Oh. Yeah. So it was just a streaker?
Well,
he was an activist.
Yeah, and he was promoting something on his shirt, and he had the little, what do you call it?
A pink smoke bomb.
Yeah, and good old Bobby Wagner, number 45 out there. So that sounds weird to say. But Bobby Wagner, playing for the Rams right now, kind of gave him that nice little knock to him, little linebacker.
Was it a legal tackle?
Yeah, it was good. Okay. Yeah. Didn't touch his head or anything like that. Didn't good. Go below the knees. But this is one of those topics that I can't stand this. I can't stand when people run on the field and do these things. I think it is dangerous for anyone, everyone involved, number one. Number two, I think it needs to be more than a misdemeanor. It needs to be a felony when you do that, because it's all fun and games until somebody, one of those football players, somebody gets actually hurt. What if somebody comes, runs down on the field and they actually have a weapon on them?
Right. You well, know. I was wondering too, because Bobby knocked him pretty good, and I thought, is that protester can, because the players aren't supposed to get involved. That's why there's security on the field. And I wonder if that protester is going to be like, oh, I'm hurt. Now I'm going to sue Wagner.
Yeah, usually, I mean, I was kind of mad at the security guy. I'm like, hey, why didn't you just hold Bobby and keep him away from that? Just joking. Sarcasm
okay.
right there.
Like,
yeah.
But
yeah,
I worry
yeah.
about the players getting sued for this now, too. But that was a good hit.
It was.
That still
it,
frame
it,
right
it
before that guy hit. Hits the ground.
And was probably, I got it, I was watching at the same time with the Mannings. It bothers me how much I like watching football with the Mannings.
Why?
Because, number one, they are like top notch at explaining the game.
Uh-huh.
I mean, like, really good. And then they have this quirkiness about them both, and it's like they're not trying to pretend to be anything, but they're just themselves.
And it bothers you?
I just wished I didn't like them.
Because
it's so corny.
It's
right?
very wholesome.
And it's like, you know, yesterday, Eli, who's a younger brother, talked about how Peyton would go to every weekend they would go to the video store and they would rent the movie Fletch, and all the time, and Eli was a younger brother, he had no choice because Peyton is the big brother. My point is just you kind of relate to that, as if you're the younger sibling, you know that you have to watch what the older sibling wants to watch. Yeah. I don't know. I was
so they hit
that.
TV gold with those two.
They really did.
Yeah.
They really did.
Oh, I want to ask about the NBA game that was played, the exhibition game between the Clippers and the Trailblazers. This is it seems like another tease that... I mean, is it another tease? I ask you the question. Is somebody trying to send a message?
Yes.
You know, hang on.
Yes.
Basketball's coming.
Yes. I do believe it's coming. I was too tired to go. My wife and she ended up taking her friend instead, and they had an amazing time. Matter of fact, she was home. She was telling me about it, and I was kind of half asleep, and she was like, this person was there, and this person was there, and everybody was there. It was packed, and then downtown was so great, and Seattle is just it's coming back. Mm-hmm. Yes. Dave, basketball, I believe, will be coming back to the city. That is a precursor right there. Think about it. This is Seattle. There's no basketball team here in Seattle. Oh, it's coming back. And what is the biggest reason why the NBA wants basketball back in Seattle? Let's see. Billionaires, money. A lot of money. So, yes.
Not because we have really super fans. It's because we have money.
We for sure have basketball fans in this town, considering all of the NBA talent that is born and bred here in this town. So this is great news. And I just, anytime, have you guys noticed lately? I know a lot of times people like to piggyback on the bad stuff that happens, which bad stuff happens everywhere. But look at all of the good things that have been happening over the last 4 days here in the city of Seattle.
Are you talking about the mascot buoy?
Yeah. First of all. Wait a minute. Hold up. I like the mascot.
What?
Didn't mascot flip the blue hair?
Oh,
hey,
gosh.
I like the mascot now. Oh. I'm not going to lie. I have said some choice words at first. And I'm like, wait a minute. I kind of like Bowie.
No.
Who's that the mascot for?
The Kraken.
Why isn't it a Kraken?
I don't know. They made some troll that looks like a broken Rainbow Bright, and I don't know. It's too nice to be a mascot.
But see, that's the thing about mascots. Mm. It'll get better once they win.
Okay.
Mm. Is he at least armed in some way?
With a broken tooth.
That's it?
Yeah.
Not a trident or anything?
No.
Huh.
Just a happy-go-lucky looking troll.
Wait, do you have to be armed?
Well, if your team's called the Kraken,
yeah.
You have to have you have to pose a threat of some kind.
The Mariner's moose has its horns.
Dave, yeah. When you rocking and rolling on Mercer Island, are you armed?
No. Heck no.
You don't have no strap, no nothing?
I don't even know what that is.
Did this turn into Dave being armed? Leave him alone.
Yeah, leave Dave alone. G and Ursula start at 9 o'clock. And since it's a Tuesday morning, we go live to Washington, D.C., a New York Times investigative reporter and Texas native, David Farenthold. He's got one of the most elite jobs in journalism, but he still has that no-nonsense Texas swagger that's unmistakable. So here we are. By the way, how are things in Texas? Is your governor still shipping out asylum seekers, or has that wound down?
No, it's still going. I saw that a busload of them arrived outside the vice president's house in D.C. Yesterday, I think. So
again,
people stopped paying attention. But yes, these folks are still being. I mean, if you know D.C. at all, it's kind of in the middle of a residential neighborhood.
Yeah.
It's just, again, these people are being moved around just to troll. It's like a human troll. But that's still going on.
And still doing it with no notice. There's a Secret Service detail there. So I guess they get on the walkie talkies and say, OK, here comes another bus.
Yeah, I mean, originally these were going to like some sort of downtown D.C., Union Station, our train station.
Yeah.
So there was like an infrastructure. It's an urban area. There was sort of a setup to take these people in. And I think that didn't get enough attention. So now they're being dropped off right outside the vice president's house. Yes, which just adds a logistical headache for everybody, especially the migrants.
Yeah. Is there some now? I did read a story. I forget whether it was in your current paper or your former paper, The Washington Post. But there's this mysterious woman who's former military who goes around. I mean, because I guess they got to get people voluntary to go on these buses, right? So they promise them stuff.
Yeah, that was a great story by my new paper, The New York Times. This was the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis. This was his stunt. Remember, he had to go to Texas to recruit people because he obviously doesn't have the Mexican border in his own state. He sent this lady that we identified as a former Army counterintelligence specialist to Texas with fake brochures advertising Massachusetts. She convinced a bunch of folks who were migrants there in Texas that Massachusetts was going to give them great services and they would get jobs there. Got them on a charter plane and then dropped them, as you recall, in Martha's Vineyard.
Right.
Just as a troll on the rich liberals that go to Martha's Vineyard. So, yeah, it seems like that was done by hiring somebody who'd been an Army counterintelligence specialist.
Yeah, well, it turns out the rich liberals came through, and I guess they're being well taken care of. My question is it can you do that? I mean, even though they're not American citizens, can you take human beings and say, hey, get on this bus, you'll have a good time, and then just take them away?
Well, if you or I did it, and you know, it's fraud. You're telling people that you represent somebody you don't represent. You're telling them that they're going to a program that doesn't exist. You know, you're getting them on an airplane with false pretenses and taking them somewhere else. You know, if you or I did that to one person, we might really get in trouble. Will the governor of Florida get in trouble for doing it to a lot of people, especially in a state where he's, you know, in Texas, where he's aligned with their politics? I don't know, but it certainly was deception. It certainly was. You know, they lied to these folks to convince them to do something, which in a lot of other contexts is against the law.
Well, this is America. Nobody is above the law. So I guess we'll see. All right. So 30 days out from the election there, I see that there are a lot of people on the congressional ballot who, it turns out, still do not buy the results of the previous election. How many?
Well, the New York Times just did a story yesterday that said there's 139 current members of the House who I think are running for re-election who objected to the, when they had the vote on January 6th, even after the riot, objected to the certifying of the election. That's plus a bunch of other people who were running for governor, for secretary of state, for attorney general in a variety of states. So there's more than 139, maybe more close to 200 people running who either disputed at the time or still do dispute the results of the 2020 election.
Okay,
which, we should be clear, we're not in dispute.
Yeah, right. I grant people, you know, I got to give them some grace to change their mind if they learn new facts in the interim. But how many are still denying the election?
I would say the majority are. There are some examples. Still. This guy, Dan Baldock, who was the nominee for Senate in New Hampshire, who during the primary was all about how the election was stolen. And as soon as he had to face a general election audience, suddenly backed off. There haven't been a few people like that. Mm-hmm. But for the majority of them, including people running for Secretary of State in Arizona and Nevada, who have not backed off at all.
Now, the latest Trump lawsuit is against CNN because apparently CNN has been calling him a liar. Actually, gone beyond that, they're using the phrase the big lie, which he objects to. So, I mean, I know that Trump has had some questionable lawsuits, but how do you get away with, I mean, what's the grounds for this lawsuit? Especially in a political campaign, you can say anything you want, can't you?
Yes. I mean, I'm no lawyer, but he has done this before a number of times since leaving office, and they get a lot of attention when the lawsuits are filed, and then they are quickly dismissed because, again, you can say that someone lied if you have evidence that they lied, and as CNN did. So I don't think this is something, even if it somehow manages to get in front of that judge in Florida who loves Trump and gives him everything he wants, the one from the Mar-a-Lago case, I don't think that this is going to go anywhere in federal court.
Oh, he filed this in the... Now, can he choose which courtroom he files it in?
He can choose the district he files it in, and then he has to hope and pray that it gets before this judge that lets him do whatever he wants. But I don't believe that has happened in this case. I believe it has been given to another judge.
Yeah. Where does the Mar-a-Lago case stand these days?
Well, it seems like we're now back to what was the situation a few weeks ago, which is that the Justice Department is able to look at the documents that it wants to look at, these classified documents. They're not, you know, being kept away from them, despite Trump's best efforts. There is an ongoing process to sort through a bunch of other documents that were not classified to see whether there's attorney-client privilege or executive privilege or something else going on. That's this quote-unquote special master you heard about. But that matters a lot less because the government now has access again to the documents at the heart of the case.
And the big question that I have to ask periodically, are we any closer to hearing an announcement from Donald Trump on what his plans are?
I don't think so. He's obviously unpredictable, and I think when he chooses to make that announcement, I do think he's going to run. When he makes that announcement, I think it's going to be at a time when he's emotionally wounded and needs some sort of way to get back in the spotlight. So, you know, I'm sure the Republicans are asking him not to do it before the 2022 midterms because that could only hurt Republican candidates, but he may do it anyway. I think he would probably prefer, all things being equal, to do it after the midterms, especially if some of his handpicked candidates managed to win these races where they're struggling now.
David Farenthold, live from the Washington Post. David, thank you.
Thank you. You can ring my
bell. Ring the bell. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And look who's here. It's Rachel Bell to explain why we should have bought our holiday air tickets 2 months ago.
What huh? is it? Yeah, chip chop, piff, puff. Get it going now.
Yeah,
the Wall Street Journal says the best gift you can give yourself is book your holiday flights now. I think people know in general you should always book earlier, but there are still a lot of things going on in the airline industry, overbooked flights and understaffed flights. And so they said it is just going to be tick, tick, ticking up. So the average price for domestic travel during Thanksgiving week this year is $468. That's up 48% compared to last year. That's according to Kayak. And then the average price for domestic travel during Christmas week this year is up to $574, which is 52% higher compared to last year,
Let's
according
just
to
all
Kayak.
Stay home.
That I don't like to fly during the holidays.
No.
I refuse. Last year, my mom made me. Usually, I don't do it. So they have a couple of tips. First of all, just do it today. Go on and look, stop procrastinating. But they said, check out low-cost carriers that you may not have flown before. They named two that I've never heard of, Avilo and Breeze. Have you heard of these?
No.
Never.
No. So they said that they have been adding more routes. They often fly into smaller airports, which could be helpful depending on where you're visiting. But be mindful, of course, that they might charge you for bringing
Isn't
bags.
Isn't it cheaper just to walk. Not move from home?
Yeah, I'm saying, like, yeah. This sounds like a lot of work. I just want to stay home, Rachel.
I know.
Not to mention, you know, we heard out of SeaTac those TSA lines that apparently took the airport by surprise. People were waiting 4 hours to get through TSA security because they're understaffed. So if it's going to be
hectic. I don't get that. People book most of their air travel ahead of time.
I know.
So somewhere there exists a list of everybody who's going to fly that day.
That's the excuse.
Why don't you
they
give that
us.
To the TSA?
They also said if this is an option for you, go abroad during Thanksgiving. It's expensive to fly within the U.S. because everyone's celebrating the same holiday that isn't being celebrated anywhere else. So, for example, if you were to fly from Chicago to Lisbon in Portugal during Thanksgiving week, that would cost $432.
That's it?
That's it. But to fly from Chicago to Phoenix would be $475.
What?
I would rather go to Lisbon than Phoenix. I've been to both places. Jeez. No yeah. question. That doesn't apply to Christmas because people do fly abroad for Christmas.
Or you could fly to Tokyo and spend your vacation in a 95-square-foot apartment.
Walking yeah. in circles.
This isn't a vacation, though. These are people who have chosen to live their life.
Just live there, huh?
In a 95-square-foot Japanese apartment. So Tokyo, Japan has always been known for small living spaces, but this is a new extreme. I don't think I would fit laying across.
No.
It's so tiny. It's
what are you? You're like 5'10".
Nine.
We're 5'9".
But I got tall hair and shoes, so especially then.
Yeah.
When I drive sometimes in a small car, I'm like Marge Simpson. My hair is literally touching the top.
Have
it's
you
bent
ever,
over.
Have you ever been Marge for Halloween?
I should.
You should, honey.
Yeah, or maybe her sisters would be more fun. Then you could, like, smoke and be mean.
Anyway, 95 square feet. The smallest I've lived in is 425, and that was awful. So I can't imagine 95.
That's
yeah.
a closet.
So
yeah.
there's 12-foot ceilings, so you have this tiny living space, and then there's a loft for your bed. I have to say, I think the whole thing kind of sounds sad. You've been reading in the news for years about, you know, the birth rate going down in Japan because young people are kind of not dating. They're not reproducing. Not like they're in a couple and they don't want to have kids. They're
well,
just
you can't fit two people in a tiny apartment like that to even have sex.
Oh, my God. One people in this article. This it's mostly people in their 20s. She said she's been dating her partner for 2 years and he's never been in that apartment because it's too small.
Oh.
But it was describing the lifestyle in Japan, which I understand a bit because I lived there 12 years ago. They say that people work long hours and they don't spend that much time at home anyway. So they get off work, they just come home and they go to sleep.
And
so
they don't
need the room.
We established that,
they
right?
Do drink.
Weren't they begging kids to drink? We just did a story with you about this.
I remember people drinking.
Oh,
I remember.
Yeah.
They said a lot of people don't cook anywhere. They just get takeout. Because, and then they were saying it was kind of confusing. They said, well, it's more sustainable because you can't own as much. You don't shop as much. But then they were saying, well, we end up using plastic and paper plates and cutlery because we don't have anywhere to dry our dishes.
So do they sleep standing up in these apartments or what?
Yeah, they're human horses.
They hang upside down like bats.
Yeah, you have to go through an intensive mammal re-identification
I see.
Kind of program. And
how much does 95 square feet cost? Do they say
cost
that?
It costs between $340 and $630 a month in American dollars.
Oh, that's worth it.
And this is to be in the hub, in the really popular areas Tokyo that are near all the cool spots. I think it sounds a little depressing.
Yeah, if Japan's worried about its population, they probably should start creating housing where couples can actually, you know.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.